Experience the thrill of the race with Scalextric, proud sponsors of the Motorsport Podcast.
Throughout the history of motor racing, the drivers have been the stars, always in the headlines. But their performance depends on some brilliant engineers. This Motorsport Podcast series explores what it takes to handle the greatest drivers in the sport by talking to some of the greatest engineers. The podcast series is brought to you in association with Scalextric, and we're joined today by Tony Southgate. During a long and successful career, which began in the 1960s, Tony has designed and engineered some of the sport's most successful racing cars in a wide range of categories. In 1968, his All-American Racers Eagle won the Indy 500. In 1974, his Shadow won the Can-Am Championship, and his Jaguars, XJR9 and XJR12, won the Le Mans 24 Hours twice. In Formula One, he worked with BRM, Lotus, Shadow, and Arrows. While away from circuit racing, he created a new rally car for Ford. In the next hour or so, we will try to cover at least some of this man's extraordinary career. Tony, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Welcome to you as well.
Look, I want to start by a really simple question, which is, how important is it actually for an engineer like you to nurture a good relationship with a racing driver?
Well, obviously, my era spans, as you say, from beginning of the 60s right through to 2000 or so. And obviously, there was a dramatic change over that period of time. In the very early days, it was a bit more basic and primitive, I suppose you could say. And now, of course, it's super sophisticated. And communicating with the drivers is still much the same. It's just that there's more knobs to press and fiddle around with them. And they go to phenomenal lengths because you're after tenths of a second all the time. Well, we were always after tenths of a second, but they tend to be bigger tenths. But in the early days, it was more of a friendship with the driver. It wasn't too technical because the cars weren't that technical, really. I mean, you had the same sort of things to adjust and fiddle around with. The tires were very small, so the tires didn't come into it so much. Whereas now, of course, they're phenomenally important. So there's a big difference there. So the feedback from the driver about tires and all that sort of thing was very little. I mean, you just had wet tires and dry tires, basically. But that sort of changed as soon as the slick era came along in the sort of 60s, 70s. When you got to the 70s, if you start at 1970 period, which is when I was at BRM, then the feedback became much more important because you had these, say, very wide, slick tires, which transmitted phenomenal sort of loads and information to the driver, and you relied on the communication between the two of you. Some drivers were fantastic. And other drivers, it didn't seem to make much difference because they didn't have what you might have called a more of technical flair. They just got in and drove the cars. As several said, the only thing I can do is drive. I've got a talent for driving. I can't do anything else. And that wasn't uncommon, amazing as it may sound. But of course, with the competition, I mean, there's always been competition, but with the pressure from all this higher tech, the drivers had to become more technical themselves. And you did get into situations where you'd have quite lengthy conversations over setups and change and what we're going to do tomorrow and all that sort of business. So it did change quite a lot as time went on. Basically, I think it was the advent of the slicks that really made a big difference, and wings, of course.
Now, when you were at BRM, you had Pedro Rodriguez on the team, who was one of my boyhood heroes. How technical was Pedro? I always imagined that he was just so quick and didn't really get too involved in the engineering.
Well, that's correct, really. He had massive charisma. He's very popular, mainly because he wasn't a fussy driver. He just got on with it, got in the car and drove it. And he was, being a small, compact little man, you can make a super little car around him. And he was not demanding at all in terms of like technical adjustments, meetings. In fact, you rarely had meetings. You just chatted as you went along. And he would feed me information. He'd say, it's a bit sort of understeer or that, and I'd make some adjustments. And he'd say, oh, that's good, that's better. And that was it. He rarely said it was worse. And he just said, oh, it's the best car I've ever driven. He said, don't touch it, things like that. You are, obviously, from the design engineer's point of view, you're trying to go a bit quicker each time, so you're trying to adjust and find a bit more speed. But well, classic example is we were qualifying one race, it'd be 970 somewhere like Spain. In qualifying, he was about fifth. This is during practice, and I said, "Well, you're running fifth, so we need to see if we can get a bit more speed." I get up the grid. He says, "Don't worry, don't worry." He says, "I'll overtake them all on the first lap." And that was his attitude. He'd rather save his effort for the race rather than hurt himself in in qualifying. And that's what happened. He'd go out and he invariably would gain a few places. And that was his approach.
That BRM was a very good car. You had a lot of reliability problems with it. Can you tell me about that? Because you had a V12 engine.
Yes, well, I was quite familiar with the old V12s. I'd come across them on several occasions. At Lola, we had the Honda V12, and Dan Gurney, he had his own V12, of course. In the case of the BRM, it was the better of the 12s. Because one, it was very light. It was basically the same weight as a DFV, which is very impressive. And it was only 2 inches longer than a DFV, which is equally impressive and very compact. The only problem is to achieve this, everything was whittled down to the minimum. So bearings were a meter or two shorter than they should be and all that sort of thing. The result was it's marginal on a lot of things, especially the lubrication, the oil system is very critical. And when I got there, they'd been blowing up engines quite regular. The oil system did look a bit primitive, basic. So I started having a go at that. And this is in 1970. Give you an idea that we'd been throwing rods through the running of the bearings, the main bearings on the Conrod. And I decided for the next race, which was Spa, I put a ginormous oil tank on it. Great big one with a massive airspace, much bigger than we'd run to, and very vertical. Quite an ugly thing, actually. Just great big rectangular lump. And I put a massive feed. And when I say massive, it was in old language, it's 1¼-inch bore tube from the bottom of the oil tank, the pickup point, straight into the oil pump, which is alongside, only about 18 inches further forward, straight in. And we, on top of that, we also boosted the oil pressure on the pump. And blow me, it went out and it won the race. If you may have been smart, it never stopped. It didn't blow up. Everybody was expecting it to blow up because he went around really quick. And he was super. He was just, this was Pedro, of course. And he was stunning. And he just went from start to finish, no problems. And we had problems after that, funny enough. But that one, it didn't miss a beat. And the biggest improvement was this enormous great oil tank and the oil system. But there were other problems which related, especially the following year in 71, where the car was actually a better car in Sydney. That was the Type 160. It was quicker there. We led a lot of races and, well, we won a couple and finished second quite often. And I did go through a spat, which is down to me, I must admit, when the coil failed. I think we were running second on three occasions, the damn car stopped and the coil had gone. And we, in the first instance, it's a Lucas coil, one of those cheap Lucas coils that's let us down. But then it did the second time. And I was, oh, right, this is, we had another look, fiddle around. And then it did the third time. By then, I realized, oh, there's a big problem. And what I'd done, I'd attached the coil to the roll bar stay, which is directly the roll bar stay went down the V of the engine. So it's very convenient, just put the coil on the stay. It only went a few inches to the distributor. So it looked really good, very neat. But the stay bolted to the gearbox. So it went right from the driver's head, if you like, to the gearbox. What I didn't realize then, it was picking up resonance from the gearbox, like a vibration going through the stay from the gearbox, and it was breaking the internals of the coil. So I tweaked it at the third stage. I thought, I'll be executed if I don't do something here. So I totally repositioned it, put in a little pot on the top of the cylinder, and we didn't have any trouble. So that was down to me. So we lost some good results there because of a tough problem.
But those are just two great examples of the kind of work that you were doing back then. I mean, they sound like really simple things, but of course,
yeah,
you got to get them right. Let's talk about Dan Gurney, can we? Because
oh, yes.
I sort of felt that must have been almost like going to university for you in the late 60s, working with Dan, because not only was he a wonderful guy, but he was also a very competent engineer, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he, when I went to AAI in the States, in California there, that was my first job when I was the chief designer. Up to then, all my jobs, I've been like the assistant designer, or in the early days, just the draftsman who drew the bits. And Dan was like a frustrated designer, but he wasn't like John Surtees, who's also like a frustrated design engineer. He was easier with it. He quite happy worked along with you and appreciated what you were doing and joining. He wouldn't try to dictate at all. He'd like to chat to you about it and things like that. And he would totally accept really what I'd want to do, assuming it sounded logical to him. But he was, he loved tinkering. He was a tinkerer. Perhaps if he hadn't tinkered so much, he might have been even more successful, because he was the type that would, like, when it got to the tracks, he would, like, decide whether he wanted this anti-roll bar, change that anti-roll bar and that type of thing, or springs, because he was driving the car and he had sufficient knowledge and feedback to tell him what he thought needed doing. And he was invariably right. But he would actually sometimes, things like, I remember on one, this is in a Can-Am race, because we raced Can-Am cars and Indy cars. He changed the anti-roll bar completely, the front anti-roll bar, on the start grid. It never actually run it. And he thought, well, a bit of a gamble, but that was, Dan would do things like that. Because obviously it was his show, he could do what he wanted. If he wanted to change it, he'd change it. So that was perhaps against him. But to work for, he was a fabulous bloke. I loved him.
And you won the Indy 500 in 1968. I mean, that's surely a day you'll never forget, but a completely different discipline, an oval, compared to all the circuit racing that you've done before.
I'd come across, been working with IndyCars for some time, because at Lola we made IndyCars, and the Lola 1, you remember, with Graham Hill driving it. And before that, I had a small stint at Brabham's in the very early days, and they made an Indy car, which I did most of the drawing of. So I was quite familiar. What I wasn't familiar with is working at the track, because I'd never been there. And of course, it was very different. And they were totally obsessed in those days with tire stagging, different diameter tires. They would mix, big ones on the outside, small ones on the inside, all that sort of thing. And they measured the growth with temperatures. They were quite fanatical about that. That was all quite new to me. But Dan would do all that because he knew what he wanted. And that was the big difference there. The rest of the car was no problem.
Tell me a bit about working with John Surtees. You've mentioned him a couple of times. And of course, another remarkable man, not only a motorcycle world champion, but a Formula One world champion. A lot of people say that he was difficult to work with. How would you sum up your work with him?
Well, he had a very close relationship with Lola's way back. Because when I first joined Lola, beginning January 62, Eric Broadley of Lola's had just built a Formula One car. It just was literally, it hadn't turned a wheel when I got there. And he's had the four-cylinder Climax in, because this is before the V8 was available. And it was just there in the workshop, all covered in a box, which I thought was fantastic. I thought I'd landed in heaven. He got a Formula One car, because nobody knew about it. It was a secret. And John drove it. John said he drove it. And Bone Makers were running it. And I went to a couple of tests, because you didn't really go to races in those days, unless you're almost the owner or the driver, of course. But we went to a couple of tests at Silverstone and things. So that was quite interesting. But he was what you call a technical driver. He liked to fiddle, and he liked to know what we're doing and why. And because he was learning from the engineers, remember. And they'd say, he fit a bigger anti-roll bar, and he said, that might affect the understeer and that sort of thing. And he go out and test it. It has made a little difference, but it's better in traction and things like that. So you'd pick it up from him. He loved that. He loved it. And I worked with him for years, right up to, he was at BRM when I joined them in 69, 70. He was difficult to work for, not for me. It may be for other people, but he really liked the Lola collaboration, because it was like his team, in effect, his company. He wasn't really. He was just like, it was beneficial to Lola's and to Eric, of course, to have someone like Surtees on board, because he was a superstar and he would drive whatever cars Eric wanted him to. He'd drive the Formula 2 or the Can-Am car or Formula 1, which he did. So he got very good feedback because he was like his team. He did a lot of the Can-Am races. I didn't find him difficult at all. He's different, and he would talk technical, and it was always a bit secret, pretend nobody's hearing what we're saying, all that sort of thing, which was quite funny. But No problem. I've heard other people say that, but perhaps that's how he appeared to us young team members.
Perhaps what they meant was that he was very demanding, which is
what. Yeah, he'd be demanding, but you expect that because, to be quite honest, it's the drivers that motivate the designers often. They'll come in and say, oh, that's a load of rubbish. I don't like that. Or what you did, or that sort of thing. So you've got to do something. This goes back to a good old Pedro, who's, when I was at BRM, they wanted me to have to, just on the Formula One car. It wasn't hardly run. And Lou Stanley wanted me to do a Can-Am car. I didn't really want to do a Can-Am car, though I was very familiar with them from Lola's, etc. He thought he was going to make a lot more money if he did it. And so reluctantly, I did it. And it wasn't really, it was never finished. The car was about 95% finished. And we shipped it off to Canada and left the mechanics to finish it off, set it up and run it. And it was horrible. It didn't work at all. And eventually, at the end of the year, Stanley just thought, oh, it's the driver. So he said, put Pedro. And Pedro had a driver in it, one of the races. No, none of us were there. We just let him get on with it. It was a very, very low budget sort of operation, really. And anyway, when he came back after the race, he came to me and he came up to me in the office and he says, you know that Can-Am car? He said, that's the worst car I've ever driven. I was so embarrassed because I haven't known it very well. I said, well, it didn't really get finished. We didn't have the right this and the right that. Didn't have the right tires. I was supposed to have wider wheels. I've got narrow wheels and all that sort of thing, which was true. And so I was so embarrassed. I said, I'll fix it. So I had a big go at it and changed it all. And we then changed the name. So it was, used to be called the 154. It became then the 167. And then it visually looked a bit different as well. And we had a wing on the back by then, of course, all the rear bodywork change. But I widened the track out to maximum because the body was bigger than the track, because we had ended up with these little wheels that were 2 inches narrower than what the car was designed for. So it all looked as though the body was bigger than the wheelbase and track, which is not a very pleasant thing to see, actually. It looked horrible. Anyway, I corrected all that, and the car was very quick. It was just the total opposite. It was good then, very good. And we were doing just the inter-series race in Europe. We just had one car and one engine and a truck and a trailer, and that was it. Yeah. They ship it off, and they go and win these races, driven by different. Redmond drove it, Howden won it, drove. I think they both won races in it. But Pedro never got to drive that car. That's the car, ironically, he would have driven. There was a race at Nürburgring. The car was due to go there. And literally about Wednesday or Thursday of that week, God was due to leave some like Thursday night, I got a message from the engine department that we only had one engine, a Chevy, which BRM had tuned up and whatever. It got damaged on the dyno. Something wrong. I don't know what it was. Nothing. They couldn't fix it anyway. They said it's damaged, so we'll have to pull out of the scratch from the race. That had just literally half an hour later, I got a phone call from Pedro saying, how's it all going? I said, well, a bit of a problem, a disaster, unfortunately. We're going to have to pull out of the race because the bloody engines failed. And his response, so he said, well, never mind. I've been offered to drive in a Ferrari for 1,500 quid. He says, good money, so I'll take that. And he got killed in it. He went off there, and I don't know what happened in the race itself, but got involved with something, and he crashed and was dead. So if the bloody engine hadn't blown up on the dyno or what it was, he'd have driven the BRM, and instead of killing himself, he'd have won the race. So a very tricky story, that, but it's true.
Tragic. While we're talking about engineering great drivers, can you tell me, is it possible to have too much information from them, as well as not enough? I'm interested in that because running a racing car can be quite a complex procedure. And have you had drivers who've just given you too much information?
No, not the drivers, because you absorb and take note of what you want. I mean, if they come in and there's something that you think, well, that's a bit trivial, I'm not worried about it. I'll worry about the big bit. You know, it's understeering into that slow corner and that's costing us speed. So you have a go at that. It may mean you compromise and muck it up somewhere else a little bit, but as long as the overall effect is a better lap time and the driver's happy with the balance, you go in that direction. I mean, you'd never get it to be perfect. To be absolutely perfect, you'd have to have a car with the world's greatest downforce so it didn't even move, and obviously the engine to go up here, go along with it and so on. That I mean, I've never come across that yet, but you could. What I have come across, however, is in the early days, we used to have telemetry on the cars, started feeding telemetry, measuring all bits and pieces. We started getting reams of data thrown at us, or I did, thrown at, well, all the other teams, I suppose, as well, if they were doing data analysis, because it was fairly new. It's all in the sort of 70s. And I remember thinking, well, we've got so much information here, I can't absorb it. There's not enough time, because we didn't have a fleet of men, remember? The designer, engineer, whatever, well, he's the engineer at the race meeting, designer in the week. So you'd be twiddling the knobs. You didn't have a fleet of men. If you were running several cars, like later, years later, like at Lotus, you'd have two people. So I'd be running one car, Colin would be running the other, and so on. And you'd have each car would also have an engineer as well. There you could spread it a bit more. You could get one to concentrate on the tire situation and so on. But I found that, in the early days, there was too much data coming through from all this analysis that I couldn't absorb it. I just used to select what I wanted. You get so many bits of information about shock absorbers with four settings going up, down, there. Then you've got, that's just one element. You've then got all the other bits. Have you got the right spring, the bump rubbers, the ground clearance, the cameras, and all that. So that there's only so many hours available. And a lot of this stuff is either happening during the race or certainly in between racing in the practice session. And whilst this is going on, you've got to grab a coffee if you're lucky and try and sort of carry on. But that's the only problem I ever came across. There was too much. Nowadays, if you look at a Grand Prix, you've got a fleet of engineers glued to monitors throughout the race. They'll have someone watching the gearbox, someone's watching the gearbox temperature performance, someone's watching the brakes, someone's watching this. And that's all they do. That's their reason for living, is to study that particular part of the car. And if there's a problem, they can immediately tell the boss or chief engineer, and he can make the decision whether to do anything about it or not. So that's how it's evolved. So now they've gone totally overboard.
Before we move on to take a look at some other highlights of your career, I'm interested to know, how did you get the motor racing bug? How did you first get interested? I mean, did you have a Scalextric set like I did? I used to play with it all the time. My dad set it up for me in the attic. Did you have one of those?
Well, I don't think it existed in my days. I've been around a while. I mean, we're talking back in the 50s. I remember the first time I went to go into motor racing, when I was about 13, 14. Mallory Park, I remember going to, and Silverstone, I went to the race there. I like race cars, because I used to have some race car books here for presents and things. And my main interest and hobbies in those early days were either making models, model aeroplanes or model boats. And I had an electric train set. The big difference was when I started driving, which was sort of about 16, driving dad's car and all that sort of thing, when you're not supposed to, of course, but you'd have but there's no traffic on the road in those days, so you'd have a check up the road and so on. But as soon as I passed my test at 17, which is still 1957, and by then I joined the 750 Motor Club, and because I got the motoring bug then, and I sort of went along to their meetings, and it just took off, because they were big into racing, club racing, and I suddenly thought, blimey, you can go racing on with nothing, because they literally went racing with no money almost, and that's how it really started. And well, it just went vertical from then.
People like Colin Chapman were involved in exactly the same thing at that
time. Yeah, identical. Well, Eric Brawley, I went to work when my apprenticeship finished in 61. I went down to see him. And, of course, 3 years before, he'd been a 1172, the 750 Motor Club champion of the 1172 Formula, which was like, in the 750 Club, the Formula One of their club. And, of course, that's what Chapman won, Len Terry won, Chevron, Derek Bennett. I think he won the championship. He certainly used to win races. Elva, they all came through that, went through the 750 Club, so apprenticeship.
This podcast is supported by Scalextric. Listeners can claim 10% off all Scalextric products by visiting www.scalextric.com and using the code RACE10. That's RACE in capital letters, followed by figure 10, RACE10, at checkout. This offer is valid until the 30th of September this year and cannot be used in conjunction with any other offer. A full list of terms and conditions is available on the Scalextric website. In 1976, you actually went to work at Lotus, didn't you, with Peter Wright, and you worked on the Lotus 78. I wondered, how inspirational was that part of your career? And I'm only asking that because there was so much innovation and creativity at Lotus at that time, wasn't there?
Colin lived for that. He liked trick cars, different cars. You've got to be different. I remember, I joined him in 76, I think, was it? Lotus owned a pretty lean time. In fact, they weren't even qualifying for some races. In those days, there were more cars than grid positions, you may remember. They have, say, 30 cars for 26 places. So four cars, the slowest four in qualifying, were out. And Lotus, I think, on one or two occasions, were out because of the car wasn't competitive and they didn't have the top drivers. Then they had the sort of good drivers, but not the top league. And I was at Shadow, and Shadow, by then, were going through a bad patch. It was all slowing down and momentum had gone. Money was very scarce. And he offered me a job to go there as chief engineer and resurrect the team, supposedly. And so I thought, well, we'll go along. So I went on a short contract, just a 15-month consolidated contract, and went as the chief engineer there. And so I'd run one car and he would run the other because they were at two, engineer one. I had Gunnar Nielsen's car. And when I joined, Gunnar Nielsen and Mario joined the team at the same time. So straight away, you got some good drivers. When I arrived, they had a car 70, it was called the 76, 70, no, 77. Yeah, 77. 77, which was a very lightweight car, a bit sort of flimsy. I was told everything had fallen off it. When I arrived, I remember saying that Nigel Bennett was one of the engineers there. He's a great pal of mine now. And I said, what hasn't fallen off this car? And he said, about 3 bits. That bit. I said, better change those. But he liked innovation. So when I got there, they were working on a wing car. It was called a wing car. Well, Peter Wright, I knew Peter Wright from BRM days. Because when I joined BRM, there was Peter Wright was in charge of the aeronautics side because we were getting into aeronautics and wing pieces, only very early stages. But he was a young chap from Cambridge, I think, and he was an aerodynamist. He was only 25. And when I got there, they'd got this wing car, BRM had a wing car, but it was very different looking, nothing like the Lotus at all. And it didn't look too good to me. And BRM wanted a car to go out and win a race, go and win, because they were at the back of the grid. They wanted to be at the front. I couldn't see this going out there. It would need a lot of development because it was very, very new technology. And the wind tunnel testing was pretty basic in those days compared to now. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped the project. I said, no, we'll make a more conventional car, but more up to date. And that's what the P153 was. And anyway, that did the job because it went out and won the first year it came out. So that was good. So after that, he left because obviously he was a bit miffed, I suppose, because I'd start that project. So when I joined years later, when I went to those, Peter Wright was there. And I remember chatting about the wing car, and he agreed. He said, no, that car that we had at BRM wouldn't have worked. I said, well, at least I've got that right. But he said, this new one is looking really good. He said, the breakthrough is, because it had wing sections on the side of the car. So did the BRM one. And Jackie Oliver did all the testing. He'd tell you all about it. They had these wing probes. You know the sort of wing section they put on the side of the March in 70? They're like these big fiberglass aerofoil sections on the side of the Formula One car, if you remember. Well, that's a direct, absolute 100% copy of the BRM. Because that's where they had those on their ordinary car to test it, see if it worked. And we couldn't tell the difference, to be honest. It looked good, but it didn't make any difference. Oliver thought he was slightly better in the wet, that's all. So we dropped them. But anyway, Peter Wright worked for Peter Jackson, made the bodyworks for Formula One cars in those days. And they made the body for the march. So he incorporated these BRM sort of head of horse sections on site. That's why it looked like that. And I mean, it looked good. It didn't really do much. But the BRM wing car was very different. It was, the whole car was a wing, and it had a little pointed nose and so on. And it didn't have any wings on the back or anything. And the cooling was in the side of the sort of. Anyway, Peter agreed that no, that wouldn't work. He said, this new one does look good. And the big difference is that the wings have got end plates on. Because, you know, like usually all the wings have end plates. But when they first came out, wings didn't have end plates. They were just rounded off like a normal aeroplane. And so they started putting these end plates on, and they found as they put bigger and bigger end plates, the downforce went up and up. And they end up, of course, if you have them so big, it touched the ground. And they realized if they could seal it, it was phenomenal. But of course, you weren't allowed to do that. You couldn't have movable devices. So one of my first big jobs on that car was to try and seal a bloody wing with, we put brushes on, all sorts of things, skirts that were like made out of polypropylene that hinged. They were on springs, but they would hinge like that as the downforce was generated. And that's how we raced the first year. You remember the 78 when it came out, race line. That was pretty good. But then Chapman, of course, he loved that wing car because it was totally different from everybody else. And nobody knew why it worked. We did, of course, but nobody else did. They couldn't believe it. And so the following year, it's his idea to come up with some skirts that slid. But because it touched the ground, so it's bloody illegal. If it was illegal, he'd go for it. He said, I'll get them to change the rules somehow. And he leaned on the FIA, I don't know how he managed, but by putting this, what it looked like a spring from the skirt to the chassis, bolting it like a leaf spring, he says it was part of the chassis. Somehow he talked them into accepting it. And of course, that meant you could have sliding skirts then. And they would just add these three springs each side. And they just disappeared, the car. The 79 was long gone. I had left it at that stage then. That was fantastic, but that was a typical Chapman. But at that same time, I remember one of the races we were at, McLaren had just come out with a new car. I think it was the 24. It's a nice car. It looked like a side radiator wedgie nose, a bit very Lotus-ish in layout, but very simple and clean. And we went up to it and looked at it, and it was going quite quick. And I said, well, whatever it is, it's working quite well. It was just a nicely made, sturdy car, really. And he looked at it with me, and he says, if I had to make a car like that, a plain looking car like that, I'd retire, because it wasn't a trick enough for him. And that was Chapman. That summed it up straight away. Got to be trick, even if it didn't work. Got to have a trick car, and then he'd worry about it working, trying to make it work afterwards. And if you look at all his cars, were always like that, nearly always. And if they weren't, it was an odd year when he didn't have enough time to. Yeah, you're working on the race cars, he'd be in the car factory. Because he wasn't in the race shop. You didn't see him he'd appear in the morning. He'd walk right through the old factory in the morning. And then you'd see him about 5 o'clock. He'd walk back again. So in between, he'd be in the car factory trying to make some money.
It's absolutely fascinating, I must say. Fascinating insight, that.
Well, there's a million stories from Lotus. You haven't got time for those. They're all true. And they're all true.
I wish we did have time. I wish we had time today. But I wanted to. There are some other things I wanted to talk to you about. In particular, coming back to drivers, because with Shadow in 1974, you won the Can-Am Championship. Jackie Oliver driving the car.
Yeah.
Now, he had this extraordinary rivalry with George Folmer, didn't he?
Yeah. When
I say extraordinary, I think they virtually came to blows a couple of times. Can you tell me about that year? The car was incredible. They won race after race after race. What was the dynamic like in the team with Jackie and George and you as a designer?
I didn't go to the races very often then. We had a big factory in Chicago where the Can-Am car worked from, operated from, and. The operation was run by Mike Hillman. He was like the team manager. Don was, of course, always around. And they had their engine department there. They were doing the engine. All the initial running of the car, because the car was obviously made here, made in Northampton here, interesting about that car, it was one of the early cars where it was spent all its life in a wind tunnel. The BRM spent a lot of time in the wind tunnel. That's where it started going big into wind tunnels. DN4, that particular car, and the previous car, the DN2, a lot of wind tunnel testing to arrive at that shape. DN2 was the same as the DN4 car that won Can-Am Championship, only it was much bigger. It was an unfortunate car. It was one that Don and the sponsors wanted me to create, and I wasn't too enthusiastic because they said, we've got a turbocharged, we want to turbocharge the Chevy, 8-litre Chevy, and we're doing it already, and it's going to have 1,250 horsepower and 1,000 foot-pounds of torque. I said, if you've got an engine with 1,000 foot-pounds of torque and 1,200 horsepower, there isn't a transmission or brakes that will either transmit it or stop it. But anyway, they said, no, that's it. So they insisted it's going to be, well, they wanted that. So I said, well, what's the fuel consumption? Straight away, it did 1.2 to the gallon. Can-Am race, you needed some ridiculous, like about 120 gallon fuel tank. Then you needed massive, because it's turbocharged, you needed much bigger brakes to stop the damn thing. So it had to have massive big brakes. So you had quite big wheels, not little wheels, and so on and so on. And the old car was massive, and I hated it. It looked at a glance all right, and it didn't work. The engine blew up all the time, and they spent most time running it without the turbos on. So it wasn't much good. And so at the end of the year, I said, well, now you need to do it properly. What you do, you just have a regular 8-litre Chevy engine. The car scaled down about 7/8 scale, so it's in the right proportion. And you can go, yes, we can have some small wheels on the front. We can get right down to the weight limit. It's a much more compact car, and so on and so on. And a bit more wind tunnel testing. Although the car still looked really similar, actually. And that's what we did. And the car, it worked very well. It was great. And we did the testing in the UK and whatever. It was all working fine. The driver, so they just sent it, shipped her off and got on with it. And it just worked.
Did you?
So it was quite easy.
did you hear about the rivalry between Oliver and Vollmer? I mean,
it was
pretty intense, wasn't it?
Well, don't forget they were the Formula One team as well. So I would be doing the Formula One, concentrating on the Formula One. So I'd be engineering both of them in the Formula One cars. But Mike Hillman will be doing that in the States with the Can-Am car. 1973, we had the both Vollmer and Oliver driving Formula One. But the rivalry, of course, was massive then because Vollmer had never done Formula One and he was brought in. And not many people realise he's not a technical driver. He just got in it and booted it, like a lot of Americans. They're very brave, what I call brave. They're sort of gutsy and brave and go for it. But they're not that sophisticated. Well, they are now, because in those days it's a bit more basic, because a lot of them came from dirt track racing and that ovals and all that sort of stuff, dirt ovals. So it's like, get the tail out and boot it, and if you were brave, you won the race sort of thing. But I remember we went to the first race, which is South Africa with the DM1. This is the first Shadow Formula One car. And Vollmer, never been in Formula One race in his life, came sixth, simply because he kept going. He kept in one piece and kept going. Not super quick, but he was there. He was six at the end. Well, now that he's six, he's quite a good place. Oliver retired. Next race was the Spanish Grand Prix, the one around the circuit, Barcelona. No, the one was street circuit.
Monjuich.
That's it. That's the one. I can never remember that. And blow me, George Vollmer came third. So in his second race, he came third in a Grand Prix, which is amazing. Well, of course, that really peed Oliver off, as you can imagine, because Ollie never came third. Or anything. So yeah, there was a lot of rivalry, and they were neck and neck, of course, in the Can-Am, and they obviously just didn't get on. I found George very easygoing, typical fun American, really, non-technical though. He wouldn't push her hard. He just tended to get anything. I think basically, he's on such a learning curve that he was learning all the time anyway, and I could dial it into. To suit what he wanted.
Well, while we're on the subject of Formula One, we have to talk about arrows because famously at the time, the first arrows Formula One car, the FA1, everyone When everyone saw it the first time, they said, well, Shadow DN9, it's just a copy. And this got into a horrible legal situation, to cut a very long story short. Was it a copy of the DN9?
Well, not a copy. As I've said many times, on the Friday, I'd finished the DN9. The car was about 95% finished, actually, in the workshop. And then there was a big bust-up. We all went down the road and started a new team. And so on the Monday, I was drawing another car, another Formula One car, exactly the same formula, because obviously you don't change your mind. I mean, after you do an old wind tunnel testing, God knows what, and you worked out what geometry you want, you don't suddenly throw it all away and start again. You'd be an idiot to do that. So obviously the car, exactly the same layout, same configuration. It was a little neater and smarter than the DN9. It had a better nose configuration. I wasn't quite happy. The radiator treatment at the front, that came out a little better. And it was a bit cleaner around the tail. These are just aerodynamic things. The rest of it is pretty much the same. And the big problem was that Jackie Oliver tried to buy into Shadow. And Don wouldn't release anyone because he owned it 100%. And he didn't want anyone else to be involved. At the time, I wasn't aware of that. But if he'd have said, well, okay, Ollie, you can have 10%, 20% or whatever of the operation to keep him involved, that'd be fine. But obviously, he wasn't prepared to give him anything. So Ollie was quite reasonably good at getting sponsorship. And he got some money lined up. So he thought, well, bugger it, we'll go down the road and start our own team. And that's how it started. And the result is that the FA1, as it was called, Franco Ambrosio, because Ambrosio coughed up with the money. He was a crook, as you may remember. Anyway, he coughed up with the money, and we built this car super quick, and it actually got to the racetrack before the DN9 did, which didn't go down very well with Don Nichols, as you can imagine. So from then on, he hated Oliver. He didn't seem to hate us, because, I mean, he was friendly with me for the rest of his days. I mean, we were still talking 18 months before he died. He wanted me to design a bloody road car for him. I said, don't be ridiculous. We've left it far too late for that. But anyway, he was always interested. He wanted a team in America. When I was working for Ferrari, he wanted to get some Ferraris and wanted me to be involved with a team, running a team and all that sort of thing. But so we're still quite friendly. But he hated Oliver because Ollie tried to take his Shadow away. And he was gunning for Oliver. And to do it, he sued Arrows. And, well, we know the full car. I mean, they couldn't win because, I mean, the car was basically a DN. It wasn't literally the same bits, but they were like copy of the bits. But the interesting thing was, on copyright, they only got fined £1,000 because in motor racing, and certainly in Formula One, copyright didn't work because copyright only works if you're selling something, and they weren't selling anything. I mean, if you sell replicas and make money, obviously you could be sued then because that's a copy of my so-and-so. But they weren't selling anything. So what happened was that as their lawyer argued that if Arrows hadn't been on the grid, Shadow would have been further up the grid because there'd be one team ahead. And of course, in those days, the grid position dictated how much money you got from FOCA and also what tyres you got. So that was quite important. And Arrows were fined £25,000. Well, first of all, they're fined actually £13,000, £12,000 for the losing out on the grid position, and £1,000 for copyright. And their lawyers protest they didn't reckon that, so the judge then doubled it to £25,000, which was nothing, peanuts, because the legal bill was 10 times that. So so all that did was to bugger up both teams. It should never have happened.
No, it was a big distraction too for everybody, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, look, Tony...
Fucked it up for me, that's sure.
Yeah. Actually, were you concerned that your reputation was also at stake there? Or, I mean, because it got quite controversial and quite nasty, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, the court, it was very nasty. It affected... In some ways, it was good, funny enough, because what happened not long after Arrows, after 3 years, there was a bust-up between me and Oliver. So I ended up out of the Arrows team. And so I then I did a little bit of work just for Teddy Yip as a stopgap. We did actually produce a couple of little cars for him, which worked quite well, considering it was a very limited budget team. But then I went to Ford and started doing sports cars and rally cars and things. I did do a thing for Ausella years later, but I went to what you might call the sports car route, which was in many ways better, because one, I got more pay, which is good, a lot more money, and you're working with names, you know, Ford, Jaguar, or Ferrari, and people like that, which is Audi, and then, which is much more better for the CV than someone like, say, Arrows.
Well, okay.
So that's right, it worked better, but from the Formula One point of view, I suppose it put a damper on it.
We've absolutely got to talk about your work at Jaguar. For no other reason than that you won Le Mans twice and you won the World Sports Car Championship twice, which is a pretty major achievement, let's face it. What was it like working for Tom Walkinshaw and TWR at the beginning with the Jaguar? Were you given a completely free rein on the engineering side?
When I went along to see Tom, when they offered me the job, which I took at about a tenth of a second to accept, when he offered me the job, do you want to design the new Jaguar Le Mans cars? Yes, because I knew that was going to be a good one, a good big project. He said to me, you can do whatever you like, long as you use the Jaguar V12 engine. They were producing a race, because they were racing the saloon cars, remember, with the V12. So they already got a race engine, not the Le Mans spec, but he was that direction. And they said, as long as you use that engine, you can do what you like. And that was it. He just said, I'd like it to be modern. Well, obviously it's going to be modern, but he meant by that, like carbon fiber and lots of aero and stuff. And that was it. But that period, the Jaguar period for me, was my best, most enjoyable of motor racing ever I did. And it was quite long. It was about 6 years or so. I had no trouble with Tom, working with Tom. I found him really, he was a racer himself. So long as you sort of came up with the goods, you were okay. If you didn't, it might have been difficult, but we were always fortunately quick enough to be, well, it's good. The car was always quick enough to be on the good side. So yeah, I loved it. I loved it really good. The engine, ended up a full race version of the V12, and it was semi-stressed and all that sort of thing, so it was all quite modern. It was a big lump, but difficult to manage because it was so heavy and big. It's the biggest engine I'd ever seen. When I came across it, I thought, oh, Struth, what do we do with this? I recessed it right next to the driver to get the weight forward and so on. And we made this very flat sump arrangement to get it as low as possible and so on. And eventually it all worked. We had teething problems like you do with those sort of big projects. But we always had the dreaded transmission. But Le Mans, for me, has always been a transmission nightmare because the gearboxes are never... It wasn't until we got the pneumatic shifting, which is, as with Audi in Germany, that came about. Some lad popped in the door. He got this thing there. He concocted the motorbikes. He said, is it any good for you? I said, that looks very interesting. We put it on the car and it was fantastic. I loved the TWR period. That was great. I'd have liked to have spent my end of my days there, but as you know, Tom went bust, because at the end in the GT era, I rejoined TWR for, we did a project with Nissan, a Le Mans car. It's a GT car, not a race car. Well, they're all race cars, but they were not prototypes, they were GTs. And unfortunately, they ran out of money. And we had super team over in Chipping Norton there, and we had to fold the whole team up, and everyone was laid off, including myself. Tom didn't want to do it. We just got no money. It was skint. Nobody would take over because we had about 45, 47 people, really good people, good facilities, a brand new design in existence, but no money.
Yeah.
So that took care of that. So I wanted to spend the rest of my days there till I fizzled out. and I had to go and get another job.
You worked with some great drivers during that period.
Oh, yes.
Now you're working with two drivers in one car, as opposed to an individual Formula One driver. Did you find it quite easy to adapt to that? How helpful or not were they? Maybe you could give me some examples of the guys you worked with and how they approached the Le Mans project with you.
Well, say you take 88, which is the year we won, because we it was 3 years before we won it. We had five cars, three drivers in each, so we had 15 drivers. 15. Well, that's our best part of a Formula One grid. But with each car, I mean, the cars were identical. There's no difference. They were set up. I mean, give you an idea, on the way to the Le Mans, all the cars would go to Myra, you know, the road test track near Nuneaton, put them in a full-size wind tunnel, and we'd set them up so that both, all the cars had the same drag, you know, just because there's always a slight difference between one car and not much, one degree on a flap and all that sort of thing. So we jiggle it out so exactly the same. So theoretically, they'd all go down the straight, same speed, assuming the engines were the same. And so they all had the same equipment. But of course, when it came to the drivers, there was like a number one, two, and three. It's inevitable. You know, Tom, he liked his drivers. And so Brundle was his star, the star driver. So he had that, he was in, you know, that car. And basically, the other two drivers had to drive what he set up. If he liked the car very pointy, which he did, John Watson, who was in number two, didn't like a pointy car. He wanted one that understeered, but it was hard luck for John Watson, unfortunately. It was a bit like that. But generally speaking, they were all okay, the drivers. And we had a massive array of drivers over the years. And there was no real big problem, except for the lead driver would tend to dominate. Or in the case of the car that won in 88, which was the young drivers, that was Lammers, Wallace, and Dumfries. They were the mad youth, you could say. All of a sudden, when it got to the race, they got very serious, all three of them. And Lammers realized they were running good and they looked good. They thought, we've got to do this right. So he starts dictating to the other drivers how to drive, you know, what to do and not don't go crashing over the curves and all that sort of rubbish and stuff of thing. And he kept a lot of pressure on them to drive properly rather than recklessly. And because 24 hours, lots of things can happen with a Le Mans car. They don't just go round and round. They end up going over curves, over halfway down ditches and all sorts of stuff. I mean, I got a photograph of the winning car, 88 car, when Dumfries, he got to the first chicane and he missed it. So he went over it. And they've got a picture of the car, and it's got about a foot of clearance on the car. He's going over the curb at the chicane like that. Yeah, really bang, bang, crash down, bang, bang, and carrying on. Well, of course, the cars are built to do that. You don't want the drivers to do it, but they have to be. It gives you main flimsy, all the bits that fall off. So even with the year they won, there were some tricky moments. But they tended to sort of lean to the senior driver and set it up for him, and that was it, really. The other ones tended to go along with it. But we did go to a race where Brundle wasn't in the car. He swapped cars, and John Watson was the lead driver, and so I dialed in a bit more to suit him, and he was suddenly the quickest driver of all our lot, going like mad he was, really quick. And I remember afterwards saying, you were really good at it. I said, well, the car was set up for me, wasn't it? Yeah, and that was it. Which it must have pissed him off when he was, you know, driving, and it's a bit pointy when he wanted the opposite.
That's very enlightening, isn't it, though, bearing in mind we're talking about, we're doing an Engineering the Greats podcast series, because that just shows you the immediate connection between people like you and people like them that can make a real difference to their performance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it works both ways, doesn't it? Obviously, if the car works well, it reflects on the designer engineers. And of course, the driver wins a race, and that's what he's doing it for. So I don't know what it's like in modern Formula One, but they still do the adjustments like everyone else. It's just that they get a bit more fanatical about, I mean, tire pressures are ridiculous. Why is it 1/10 of a pound and all that sort of thing? In my day, I mean, you just went up and down a pound. bugger around.
Can we talk briefly about the Ford rally car? Because now, yes. Now this is yet another completely different discipline. And you've already spent decades, you know, creating and engineering these amazing cars, and now Ford want you to do a rally car. It was quite a big challenge.
Well, I first joined Ford to do a Le Mans car, the Mark III C100, it was called, and which benefited the Jaguar, in fact, because it was the forerunner of the Jaguar. It only wasn't carbon fiber. And that was a nice project. It worked out well, all looking really good. We did 1,000-kilometer testing, no real problems, a couple of little minor things. And then Ford's scrapped it because by then they got a new competition manager, which is Mike Turner. And he was pro-rally and wasn't too keen on Le Mans. So they scrapped it. And then a few weeks later, after various consultations, they said, do you want to design a Group B rally car? I said, well, I don't know much about rally, but I said, we'll have a go, let's see. And so I went down to Boreham. We went around a test track at Cobham, I think it was, in one of their current rally cars. It was an escort of some sort, with their chief engineer at the wheel, who was obviously a frustrated rally driver. And we went around this track for about 3 laps. At the end of it, I was exhausted. I mean, it's crashing around and banging up and down, hitting the ground. The noise was phenomenal. The seatbelts were almost cutting my shoulders off. And I got out there. He said, if you do 3 laps around it, it's pretty damn good for a rally car. So he said, you've got to be able to do about 12 laps around here. If it doesn't fall to bits, you can win a rally. So he was just giving me a feel. I said, okay. So I thought, well, we don't want it too flimsy then. And so I did a layout. And eventually they said, well, it's all a bit too wet. It's a bit Formula One-ish. We compromised and ended up doing a more sturdier, simpler version. They said things like they want to be able to change the gearbox in 9 minutes and upright in 4.5 minutes and all that sort of thing. And one of the requests was, could you just use one size nut and bolt? I said, well, throughout the car. And they were using like 7/16 bolt size, which I never even used a bolt that size. They're all like, you know, 5 or 6 at the biggest, at or 4. So anyway, we ended up making a honeycomb monocoque structure, which they were very anti. Fords were only into spot welded steel. So I had to make a section of the car, prove how strong it was, and we put it in the press and compared it with the steel. Of course, it was umpteen times better than the steel. And so they had a bit of eye out and said, that's right, perhaps it does. It's okay. So we made a nice structure there, which is good. And they said, you can do what you like, incidentally. They said, we got a load of Hewlin gears. You can use some Hewlin internal a gearbox or something. So, okay, we'll see. So one compromise I did do, and I think it's correct anyway. The chief engineer at Boreham, when I was there, he was fanatical about weight distribution because I added the weight, I had a bit heavier on the rear than the front. And he said, it's got to be 50-50 rally car because they're used to front engine rally cars, which generally are about 50-50 weight distribution. Oh. And he was terrified if we had one that's sort of 45 or something, it'd be understeering off the road. And so after much discussion, I said, okay, I'll go along with that then, because he got much more experience. I said, I'll go along with that and we'll put a bit more weight on the front. And we ended up putting the gearbox at the front. I wasn't too keen on that because you've got to have a drive shaft going forward and a drive shaft coming back. So the place is crawling with drive shafts, prop shafts, rather. And anyway, we went that route and put the gearbox at the front. And I was quite happy with it. In the end, I thought it was definitely right because wet distribution came out very nice. So that was the only compromise that I made. The rest of it, packaging, the length and all that was just as I drew the car. And it had a very short nose and a very short tail. Just drew it like literally drew a line, said, right, that's it. It's got to be within that package. And the roof is this high. I used lots of Ford production bits, like the door is a Sierra, because the Sierra had just come out then. I took a Sierra door, just chopped, I can't remember, 6 inches or 9 inches off the bottom, and obviously made a fiberglass version of it, and that was the door. So it means if you use all the window mechanisms and door opening mechanisms, which are a pain in the neck, I use the Sierra windscreen and all the wiper mechanism and the little bit that goes around it, because you don't want to get into making those things. It's a nice shape. And the top of the roof, the first part of the roof would be Sierra. Then, of course, he tailed off the shape. So that center bit was almost like Sierra, the windscreen and all the door, what have you. And then Gia in Italy then styled the nose and the tail. And we had a sort of flip-up tail, try and get some downforce and a shovely nose. And I went over to Gears when they were doing it, which is quite interesting experience seeing them do it. And that was it. It went in the wind tunnel afterwards. It did produce downforce, not much, about £120, I think, downforce. But most cars produced lift. So that was useful. And the car, it had lots of suspension, 8 inches of wheel movement, double shocks all round, which was packaging was a bit tricky. And of course, it had a mid-engined turbocharged engine, which had to drive forward to the gearbox, then drive back to the back axle. But they thought there'd be a lot of problems with that. And I said, well, I'm not sure. I think it'll be okay. But I know Ford engine as well, or the inertia of the prop shafts and all this, we'll be able to change gear. In actual fact, the only thing I noticed was because the gearbox was rubber mounted. As you change gear, the gear lever moved, because obviously as you drove, the drive going through the gearbox move the rubber bushings. And so I remember in the car, it's funny, the gear lever was moving like this. The only thing I considered. But we did a test at Myra, ran all the circuit there, this on the road circuit, and Jackie Stewart was doing the driving, and I was sitting next to him, because he had to test all the cars for Ford. So he went whizzing around that, which is quite a good experience, getting these comments. Oh, it's very nice, very nice. Handles quite nice. And that's why he handled very well for that type of car. And of course, you've got the challenge. It's got to work in the snow, gravel, sand, tarmac. So we had double suspension points, so you could lift the car up or down. If you're on a tarmac, like racetrack area, you could drop the car. The whole car would come down. I mean, wheels from this narrow to this. And you've got to make it all work, which is quite a challenge. And anyway, it all worked, and the drivers were quite complimentary, actually. The only snag is, of course, by the time you had to make 200 of the damn things, 200. And we ended up going to Reliance to get them to make the bodywork. They were making fiberglass much better than anyone else. They're like, you know, Lotus went off and did their injection molding bodywork, which is fine, but it's a bit trick, and it took a long time for them to perfect it. But what Reliance did, they just had a press, like two halves. You put fiberglass in, put the two parts of the mold together, heated it up, and 2 minutes later you opened it up, and out came a bit of very hot fiberglass, shiny both sides. So it didn't look like fiberglass. It just looked like a shiny bit of plastic. And they thought that was, forceful, that was pretty impressive. So they got them to make the bodywork. That was the idea. Actually, it was an interesting project. I was on that, I spent more time on that car, the RS200, than any other car ever in my career, because it's a big project.
I don't know how we could possibly cover your career in such a short time, and we haven't. But you've been incredibly entertaining and informative, and thank you so much for taking part. And a big thank you too to Scalextric for supporting our Motorsport Engineering the Greats series. Tony, just to say thank you very much. Well done. I wish we had more time, but what we've done, I don't know, an hour and 20. You'll probably need a cup of tea.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
It is tea time. Exactly.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry we've only scratched the surface, but hey, I mean, how do you do 5 decades in...
A bit tricky, that. Anyway, it's okay. That's fine. It's fine.
Thank you, Tony, very much. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Experience the thrill of the race with Scale Extric, proud sponsors of the Motorsport Podcast.